long, and a merlin shivers in its wicker mew on the box mounted behind her. The wind hushes. The trees cease stirring. Marie feels that the whole countryside is watching her move through it. She is tall, a giantess of a maiden, and her elbows and knees stick out, ungainly. The fine rain gathers until it runs in rivulets down her sealskin cloak and darkens her green headcloths to black. Her stark Angevin face holds no beauty, only canniness and passion yet unchecked. It is wet with rain, not tears. She has yet to cry for having been thrown to the dogs. 2 days earlier, Queen Eleanor had appeared in the doorway of Marie's chamber, all bosom and golden hair and sable fur lining the blue robe and jewels dripping from ears and wrists and shining chaplet and perfume strong enough to knock a soul to the ground. Her intention was always to disarm by stunning. Her ladies stood behind her, hiding their smiles. Among these traitors was Marie's own half-sister, a bastardess sibling of the crown just like Marie, the sum of errant paternal lusts. But this simpering creature, having understood the uses of popularity in the court, had blanched and run from Marie's attempts to befriend her. She would one day become a princess of the Welsh. Marie curtsied clumsily, and Eleanor glided into the room, her nostrils twitching. The Queen said that she had news. Oh, what delightful news! What relief! She had just now received the papal dispensation. The poor horse had exploded its heart it had galloped so fast to bring it here this morning. That, due to her, the Queen's own efforts over these months, this poor illegitimate Marie from nowhere in Le Mans had at last been made prioress of a royal abbey. Wasn't that wonderful? Now at last they knew what to do with this odd half-sister to the crown. Now they had a use for Marie. At last. The Queen's heavily lined eyes rested upon Marie for a moment, then moved to the high window that overlooked the gardens, where the shutters were thrust open so Marie could stand on her toes and watch people walking outside. When Marie's mouth could move, she said, thickly, that she was grateful to the Queen for the radiance of her attention, but oh no, she could not be a nun. She was unworthy, and besides, she had no godly vocation whatsoever in any way at all. And it was true. The religion she was raised in had always seemed vaguely foolish to her, if rich with mystery and ceremony, for why should babies be born into sin? Why should she pray to the invisible forces? Why would God be a trinity? Why should she, who felt her greatness hot in her blood, be considered lesser because the first woman was moulded from a rib and ate a fruit, and thus lost lazy Eden? It was senseless. Her faith had twisted very early in her childhood. It would slowly grow ever more bent into its geometry until it was its own angular, majestic thing. But at 17, in this spare chamber at the court in Westminster, she could be no equal to the elegant and story-loving queen who, though small in body, absorbed all light, all thought from Marie's head, all breath from her lungs. Eleanor simply looked at Marie, and Marie had not felt so small since she'd last seen Le Mans, her six Amazon aunts gone to death or marriage or convent, and her mother taking Marie's hand and pressing it to the egg growing between her breasts, smiling hugely but with tears in her eyes, saying, "Oh, darling, forgive me. I'm dying." And that great strong body so swiftly reduced to skeleton, acrid breath, then no breath at all. And Marie, pressing all her vitality down into the ribs, all her prayers, but the heart stayed still. 12-year-old Marie's bitter anguish at the high, windy burial ground. And afterward, the 2 years of loneliness,